Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This episode, we bring you Chinua Achebe. It's a talk from Portland Arts and Lectures in 1998. Achebe was born in 1930 in eastern Nigeria and was educated in local public schools. He was one of the first ever graduates of the University of Ibadan. He got his start at Nigerian Public Radio as a producer and as director of external broadcasts, and it was during this time that Achebe started writing. His first book, Things Fall Apart, published in 1958, is considered a world classic and his magnum opus. After Things Fall Apart came No Longer at Ease, Arrow of God, A Man of the People, and Ant Hills of the Savannah. Later, Achebe edited several anthologies, including the essay collections Mourning Yet on Creation Day and Hopes and Impediments, and the poetry collection Beware Soul Brother. Possibly his most crucial editorial contribution is as the founding editor of the Heinemann series on African literature, a list that now has more than 300 titles, many of which, through their selection in the series, have risen to prominence. Chinua Achebe spent a lifetime writing about Africa and supporting African writers. Because of this work, Achebe is largely credited as helping to create and define what we now identify as 20th century African literature. Achebe passed away in 2013 at the age of 82. Let's listen to Chinua Achebe now on Literary Arts, the Archive Project. This is from the 1998 Portland Arts and Lectures series.
Thank you very much. Thank you, indeed. I am delighted to be here, and I'm glad to see so many people. I want to thank the organizers of this program for inviting me, and Robert Lyons for agreeing to accompany me. I will read, first of all, a short piece from my fiction, and then I will spend the rest of the time reading my poetry. I know I'm not very well known as a poet, but some years ago, when I was invited to read by one of the colleges and Cambridge University in England, I read my poetry, and at the end of it, the chairman said, "Everybody knows about your fiction. Why don't we know about your poetry?" And I said, "There's a conspiracy against my poetry." And he promised to do all he could to destroy that conspiracy. So I'm doing my part, too, by reading poetry whenever I can. But let me begin with a passage. There's an old man. This is from Ant Hills of the Savannah, my 1987 novel. And the passage I'm going to read is an extract from a longish speech made by an old man who is leader of his people in a drought-ridden section of the country. And this old man has come to the capital to appeal to the leaders. This country is under military rule, and he has come to appeal to the leaders of his country to come to the help of his drought-stricken community. And the reason he's doing this is that the project to supply water to this community had been withdrawn by the government because this province had not behaved very well. And so he's come to appeal to the leaders. And this is what he says at the end of the visit. This is what he says to a small group that has come together at the Capitol to receive him. When we were told 2 years ago that we should vote for the big chief to rule forever, and all kinds of people we had never seen before came running in and out of our villages asking us to say yes, I said to my people, we have Osudi in the capital. If he comes home and tells us that we should say yes, we will do so, because he is there as our eye and ear. I said, if what these strange people are telling us is true, Osudi will come, or he will write it in his paper, and our sons will read it and know that it is true. But he did not come to tell us, and he did not write it in his paper. So we knew that cunning had entered that talk. There was another thing that showed me there was deception in the talk. The people who were running in and out of our villages and telling us to say yes came one day and told us that the big chief himself did not actually want to rule forever, but that he was being forced. Who is forcing him? I asked. The people, they replied. That means us, I said, and their eyes shifted from side to side, and I knew finally that cunning had entered the matter. And I thanked them, and they left. I called my people and said to them, the big chief doesn't want to rule forever, because he is sensible. Even when a man marries a woman, he does not marry her forever. One day one of them will die, and the marriage will end. So my people and I said no. But that was not the end. More shifting-eyed people came and said, because you said no to the big chief, he is very angry and has ordered all the water boreholes they are digging in your area to be closed, so that you will know what it means to offend the sun. You will suffer so much that in your next reincarnation, you will need no one to tell you to say yes, whether the matter is clear to you or not. So we came to Bassa to say our own yes. And perhaps the work on our boreholes will start again, and we will not perish from the anger of the sun. We did not know before, but we know now that yes does not cause trouble. We do not fully understand the new ways of the world, but we are learning. A dancing masquerade in our town used to say, it is true I do not hear English, but when they say, catch 'em, nobody tells me to take myself away. So we are ready to learn new things and mend our old useless ways. If you cross the great river to marry a wife, you must be ready for the risk of night journey by canoe. I don't know whether the people we have come to see will listen to our cry for water or not. Some time ago, we were told that the big chief himself was planning to visit our villages and see our suffering. Then we were told again that he was not coming because he had just remembered that we had said no to him 2 years ago. So we said, if he will not come, let us go and visit him instead in his house. It is proper that a beggar should visit a king. When a rich man is sick, a beggar goes to visit him and says, sorry. When the beggar is sick, he waits to recover and then goes to tell the rich man that he has been sick. It is the place of the poor man to make a visit to the rich man who holds the yam and holds the knife. Whether our coming to the big chief's compound will do any good or not, we cannot say. We did not see him face to face because he was talking to another big chief like himself who is visiting from another country. But we can go back to our people and tell them that we have struggled for them with what remaining strength we have. Once upon a time, the leopard, who had been trying for a long time to catch the tortoise, finally chanced upon him on a solitary road. "Aha," he said, "at long last, prepare to die." And the tortoise said, "Can I ask one favor before you kill me?" The leopard saw no harm in that and agreed. "Give me a few moments to prepare my mind," said the tortoise. Again, the leopard saw no harm in that and granted it. But instead of standing still, as the leopard had expected, the tortoise went into strange action on the road, scratching with hands and feet and throwing sand furiously in all directions. "Why are you doing that?" asked the puzzled leopard. The tortoise replied, "Because even after I am dead, I would want anyone passing by this spot to say, yes, a fellow and his match struggled here." My people, that is all we are doing now, struggling. Perhaps we are struggling to no purpose, except that those who come after us will be able to say, "True, our fathers were defeated, but they tried." The first poem I shall read is "We Laughed at Him." We laughed at him, a hungry-eyed fool man with itching fingers, who would see farther than all. We called him visionary, we called him missionary, we called him revolutionary, and, you know, all the other narries that plagued the peace. But nothing would deter him. With his own nails, he cut his eyes. scraped the crust over them, peeled off his priceless patina of rest, and the dormant fury of his damned pond broke into a cataract of blood tumbling down his face and chest. We laughed at his screams, the fool man who would see what eyes are forbidden, the hungry-eyed man, the look-look man, the itching man bent to drag into daylight fearful signs hidden away for our safety at the creation of the world. He was always against blindness, you know, our quiet, sober blindness, our lazy, he called it, blindness. And for his pains, a turbulent, torrential, cascading blindness behind a Congo river of blood. He sat backstage then, behind his flaming red curtain, and groaned in the pain his fingers unlocked, in the rainstorm of blows loosed on his head by the wild avenging demons he drummed free from the silence of their drum house, his prize for big-eyed greed. We sought by laughter to drown his anguish, but suddenly one day at height of noon, his screams turned to hymns of ecstasy. We knew then his pain had risen to the brain, and we took pity on him, the poor fool man, as he held converse with himself. We heard him say, "My Lord," to the curtain of his blood, "I come to touch the hem of your crimson robe." He went stark mad thereafter, raving about new sights he claimed to see, poor fellow. Sights you and I know are as impossible for this world to show as for a hen to urinate, if one may borrow one of his many crazy vulgarisms. He raved about trees topped with green and birds flying, yes, actually flying through the air, about the sun and the moon and stars, and about lizards crawling on all fours. But nobody worries much about him today. He has paid his price, and we don't even bother to laugh anymore. I seem to have lost my piece of paper. The next poem is called Remembrance Day. Before I read it, I'd like to tell you something briefly about the background to this poem. At the end of the Biafran War, it struck me that we were going back to rituals that didn't really apply to us. And one of them was the ritual of remembering those who died in war, and the manner of remembering it. We had learned the European Remembrance Day, a day on which soldiers march, slow march, the flag is flying at half-mast, and all that. And it seemed to me that if we had thought about it, our ancestors had a different way of remembering people who died in wars. What they did one day in the year among the Igbo people, one day in the year, all able-bodied men run away from the village, run to neighboring villages, And if they are too sick or too whatever, unable to run away, then they went into their bedroom and lay not on the bed, but under the bed. They would go, in fact, into hiding. And why did they do this? Because the spirits of those who died in previous wars would come to the village that day, and they would want to know why you were alive and not dead like them. See? And it seemed to me this was altogether a better way to remember those who died in wars, for those who died so that we would live. And this poem was a product of that thinking. You are proclaimed mourning, your flag at half-mast, your solemn face, your smart backward step and salute at the flowered foot of empty graves, your glorious words, none, nothing will their spirit appease. Had they the choice, they would gladly have worn for you the same stricken face, gladly flown your drooped flag, spoken your tremulous eulogy, and been alive. Admittedly, you suffered too. You lived wretchedly on all manner of gross fare. You were tethered to the nervous precipice day and night. Your groomed hair lost gloss, your smooth body roundedness. Truly, you suffered much. But now you have the choice of a dozen ways to rehabilitate yourself. Pick any one of them, and soon you will forget the fear and hardship, the peril on the edge of the chasm. The shops stock again a variety of hair dyes. The lace and the gold are coming back. So you will regain lost mirth and girth and forget. But when? How soon will they their death? Long, long after you forget, they turned newcomers again before the hazards and rigors of reincarnation. Rude clods once more, who once had borne the finest scarifications of the potter's delicate hand, now squashed back into primeval mud. They will remember. Therefore, fear them. Fear their malice, your fallen kindred, wronged in death. Fear their blood feud. Tremble for the day of their visit. Flee, flee, flee your guilt palaces and cities. Flee, lest they come to ransack your place and find you still at home at the crossroad hour. Pray that they return empty-handed that day to nurse their red-hot hatred for another long year. Your glorious words are not for them, nor your proliferation in a dozen cities of the bronze heroes of Idumota. Flee, seek asylum in distant places, till a new generation of heroes rise in phalanges behind their purified child priest to inaugurate a season of atonement and rescue from fingers calloused by heavy deeds the tender rites of reconciliation. On the issue of death, I'm going to read you a short poem which I called Their Idiot Song. This is a reflection of a pagan, a heathen, an old man who refused to be converted. And he comes to a Christian funeral, and he hears the Christians singing a song in which they talk about how they had overcome the stings of death. You know, death, where is thy sting? And this is his reflection on hearing that. These fellows, the old pagan said, surely are out of their mind. That old, proudly impervious derelict, scattered long ago by flood waters of salvation. Behold the great and gory handiwork of death, displayed for all on dazzling white sheets this hour of day, its twin nostrils plugged firmly with stoppers of wool, and they ask of him, where is thy sting? Sing on, good fellows, sing on. Someday when it is you he decks out on his great iron bed with cotton wool for your breath, his massing odors mocking your pitiful makeshift defenses of face powder and township ladies' lascivious scent. These others, roaming yet his roomy chicken coop, will be singing and asking still, but you, by then, no longer will be in doubt. Refugee mother and child. No Madonna and child could touch that picture of a mother's tenderness for a son she would soon have to forget. The air was heavy with odors of diarrhea, of unwashed children with washed out ribs and dried up bottoms, struggling in labored steps behind blown empty bellies. Most mothers there had long ceased to care, but not this one. She held a ghost smile between her teeth, and in her eyes, the ghost of a mother's pride as she combed the rust-colored hair left on his skull. And then, singing in her eyes, began carefully to part it. In another life, this would have been a little daily act of no consequence before his breakfast and school. Now she did it like putting flowers on a tiny grave. Beware, soul brother. We are the men of soul, men of song. We measure out our joys and agonies too, our long, long passion week in paces of the dance. We have come to know from surfeit of suffering that even the cross need not be a dead end nor total loss, if we should go to it striving the dirge of the soulful Abia drums. But beware, soul brother, of the lures of Ascension Day, the day of soporific levitation on high winds of sky song. Beware, for others there will be that day, lying in wait, leaden-footed, tone-deaf, passionate only for the deep entrails of our soil. Beware of the day we head truly skyward, leaving that spoil to the long ravenous tooth and talon of their hunger. Our ancestors, soul brother, were wiser than is often made out. Remember, they gave Allah, great goddess of the earth, sovereignty too over their arts, for they understood too well those hard-headed men of departed dance, where a man's foot must return whatever beauties it may weave in air, where it must return for renewal of strength. Take care then, mother's son, lest you become a dancer disinherited in mid-dance, hanging a lame foot in air like the hen in a strange, unfamiliar compound. Pray protect this patrimony to which you must return when the song is finished and the dancers disperse. Remember also your children, for they in their time will want a place for their feet when they come of age, and the dance of the future is born for them. It's a short one. Butterfly. Speed is violence. Power is violence. Weight, violence. The butterfly seeks safety in lightness, in weightless, undulating flight. But at a crossroads where mottled light from trees falls on a brash new highway, our convergent territories meet. I come power-packed enough for two, and the gentle butterfly offers itself in bright yellow sacrifice upon my hard silicon shield. A little bit of humor, I think, may be in order. Here's a poem called Non-Commitment. Hooray to them who do nothing, see nothing, feel nothing, whose hearts are fitted with prudence like a diaphragm across womb's beckoning doorway to bar the scandal of seminal rage. I'm told the owl too wears wisdom in a ring of defense round each vulnerable eye, securing it fast against the darts of sight. Long ago in the Middle East, Pontius Pilate openly washed involvement off his white hands and became famous. Of all the Roman officials before him and after, who else is talked about every Sunday in the Apostles' Creed? And talking of apostles, that other fellow Judas wasn't such a fool either. Though much maligned by succeeding generations, the fact remains he alone in that motley crowd had sense enough to tell a doomed movement when he saw one and get out quick, a nice little packet bulging his coat pocket into the bargain. Sensible fellow. The last two poems I shall read were written as tributes to poets who died. The first one I wrote to Agostino Neto, who some of you might remember, was the first president of Angola. Before he became president, he was a physician and also a poet. And it is said that he was in his practice, in his surgery, in the area of Luanda, when one day he saw a very brutal act against one of his people by the Portuguese colonizers. And that he went back and thought about it, and he wrote a poem which he called To My Mother. And in this poem, there was a memorable sentence. It says, I wait no longer. I am the awaited. And he shut down his surgery and went into the forest where there were already freedom fighters, and he joined them. And it is said that as these people fought against the Portuguese, they chanted some of his poems. I wrote this poem for Agostino Neto. Neto, were you no more than the middle child favored by fortune? Kwame striding ahead to accost demons. Behind you, a laggard third, as yet unnamed, of twisted fingers. No, your secure strides were not given to you. Your feet mastered their fierce balance in the slopes of humiliation. Your delicate hands patiently groomed for finest incisions were commandeered brusquely to kill, your melodious voice to battle cry. Perhaps your family and friends knew a flash cracking that gloom I know in pictures, but I prefer and will keep the sorrowful legend. Half a millennium of alien rape and murder can stamp a smile on the vacant face only of the fool. The sinister grain of Africa's idiot kings who oversee in obscene palaces of gold the butchery of their own starving children. Neto, I sing you are passing. I, timid requisitioner of your vast armory's most congenial supply. What shall I sing? A dirge answering the gloom? No. I will sing tearful songs of joy. I will celebrate the man who rode a trinity of awesome fates to the cause of our trampled race. Thou, healer, soldier, and poet. The last poem I will read in my mother tongue, it's a poem written to the poet Christopher Okibo, who was killed in the Biafran War. At the time of his death, some of us considered him the brightest and the most original of all our poets. But before I read the poem in Igbo, I'd like you to know what I'm saying. So I'm going to invite my wife to read the translation into English, which is done by a friend of mine, a poet. And so you know roughly what I'm saying. I'm not, so that you will know that I'm not cursing you. Which, yes. Please. Just before you begin, just one other thing I like to say. You will hear a refrain, both in the English and in the Igbo versions. Nzomalizo. I think what that means, because it's really not, it's a kind of nonsense refrain, but it isn't. Zo in Igbo means to hide. And when you have it in the form of zomalizo, it introduces the notion of playfulness, hiding in playfulness. And this comes from a traditional dirge which the Igbo people use when a young person, a young man or a young woman dies. Members of his or her age set will go around the village through the night, singing, looking for this person. They have heard rumors of death, but they don't accept it. They say he or she has gone to the stream or has gone to the market or has gone to fetch firewood, and he will come back. And they do this through the night until morning. If they don't find their colleague, then they will accept the notion of death. So that's what that's the format I used in writing the poem to Okiwo. Thank you.
Awake for Okiwo. For whom are we searching? For whom are we searching? For Okiwo we are searching. Nzomalizo. Has he gone for firewood? Let him return. Has he gone to fetch water? Let him return. Has he gone to the marketplace? Let him return. For Okiwo we are searching. Nzomalizo. For whom are we searching? For whom are we searching? For Okiwo we are searching. Nzomalizo. Has he gone for firewood? May Uboko not take him. Has he gone to the stream? May Iyi not swallow him. Has he gone to the market? Then keep from him, you tumult of the marketplace. Has he gone to battle? Please, Obonuke, step aside for him. For Okiwo we are searching, Nzomalizo. They bring home a dance. Who is to dance it for us? They bring home a war. Who will fight it for us? The one we call repeatedly. There's something he alone can do. It is Okiwo we are calling, Nzomalizo. Witness the dance, how it arrives, the war, how it has broken out. But the color of the dance is nowhere to be found. The brave one in battle is nowhere in sight. Do you not now see that whom we call again and again, there is something he alone can do? It is Okiwo we are calling, Nzomalizo. The dance ends abruptly. The spirit dancers fold their dance and depart in midday. Rain soaks the stalwart, soaks the two-sided drum. The flute is broken that elevates the spirit. The music pot shattered that accompanies the leg in its measure. Brave one of my blood, brave one of Igbo land, brave one in the middle of so much blood, owner of riches in the dwelling place of spirit. Okibo is the one for whom I am searching. Nzomalizo.
Ụnọ ọnwụ Okigbo, ọ bụ onye ka anyị na-achọ? Ọ bụ onye ka anyị na-achọ? Okigbo ka anyị na-achọ. Nzomalizo. O jelu nkụ ya nata, o chulu iyi ya nata, o jelu afịa ya nata. Okigbo ka anyị na-achọ. Nzomalizo. Ọ bụ onye ka anyị na-achọ? Ọ bụ onye ka anyị na-achọ? Okigbo ka anyị na-achọ. Nzomalizo. O jebe nkụ ugboko elinia, o chube mmili iyi elinia, o jebe afịa ụzụ afịa sọọlịa, o jebe agha ọgbọnụ kebiko chaalịa. Okigbo ka anyị na-achọ. Nzomalizo. Ezite egwu onye ga-agbala anyị, eseta ọgụ onye ga-agbala anyị, onye a na-akpọ nwere ife ọ na-eme. Okigbo ka anyị na-akpọ. Nzomalizo. Ngwa na egwu ka ọ na-abịa, ifugo na agha awa, ọgụ egwu choo dike na ọgụ chaa. Ifrozi na onye a na-akpọ nwere ife ọ na-eme. Okigbo ka anyị na-akpọ. Nzomalizo. Egwu ebe na mberede, mmọnwụ anyị ewelu mgbaghachi na mmiri ama dike maa ọkanga, ọja na aja n'imọọ apịarị, udu na-edu ọkpa egwu awarị. Okolo nne m, okolo Igbo, okolobịa na ọgbọ mme, ọgaranya na be mmọọ. Okigbo ka m na-achọ. Nzomalizo. Thank you.
Part of the evening, we'd like to take some time and go through this idea of the images of Africa. I think that the poetry and prose that we've heard has created a kind of wonderful and beautiful imagery of what that place is like, some of the ways it is. And what I'd like to do is show you first some of the ways that we've been taught to see Africa, or the biased and slanted ways historically, and then go into some work that I think is a more accurate portrayal of the place. There are a lot of myths that we have about Africa, and some of these myths, including Africa as the dark continent, Africans as the noble savage, Africa as an open-air ethnographic museum, and Africa as in famine, chaos, and civil war. What I'm going to attempt to show you is another Africa, which is what Chinua and I have been working on in the book, and also to show you a little bit how many other people are working on that in terms of visuals. So I'm just going to go over to the podium to do slides from there. I'd like to read a brief quote that comes from a book called Fantastic Invasion. It was written in the late 1970s and then reissued in the late 1980s by Patrick Marnheim. Perhaps it is not surprising that just as the North sees Africa more and more on its own terms, so it uses the continent more and more blatantly for its own ends. Even African suffering is now celebrated in festivals and exhibitions as an opportunity for us to congratulate each other on our compassion. Our photographers arrange the dead and dying of the Sahel in visually harmonious groups and then give each other's awards for their achievements. One American photographic team working in Ethiopia in 1985 were taken to a tent full of dying children. First, they turned on their powerful lights, although the temperature inside the tent was already insufferably hot. Then they insisted that the children be covered in makeup to restore their skins to the original shade of gray. Then they roused the children into tears because they said that they looked too peaceful when they were asleep. Asked to justify these unkind attentions, they said that the resulting photographs would raise money for emergency relief. And so what starts as a generous impulse turns into a creation of a new pornography, a pornography of suffering. And when the pop concerts and publicity stunts are forgotten, the only lasting result is an endorsement of those very development programs which are responsible for so much of that suffering in the first place. Let's see if we can go to these first two slides. These first slides are some historical images of Africa. The one on the left, the photographer is unknown, the apostolic vicar and an orphan. And I believe the one on the right is the sons of cannibals contemplating the passion of the Redeemer. I think this kind of sets the tone of how people were looking at a certain time at the African continent. These are more typical of what was done in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s into the 1960s. The picture on the left is actually George Eastman on safari a few years before his death with his prize trophy. And the picture on the right is from the same safari of people viewing a phonograph and making it in the people into spectacle, I believe. The picture on the left is a picture of Bororo girls, and it was done in 1977 by an African photographer. The picture on the right is from a 1926 National Geographic. Its title, or the caption says, "She has devoted her life to making herself beautiful." I think you can see from these two images a very different view, both looking at people in another way, but the one on your left is quite provocative, quite thought-provoking about who these people are. It's penetrating, and it's not people a spectacle. One other issue I want to deal with early on this evening is the idea of photography as fiction. Briefly, what happens with a great photograph is that it suspends one's disbelief that you're looking at a photograph and you tend to believe it as reality. I think we all know now that many, many images are not reality. They're the view or a particular view of the photographer. There's a really nice quote from The Truth of Fiction, from Hopes and Impediments, which is a book of essays by Chinua. I'd like to read it to you. "Given the great gulf between being and knowing, between essence and existence, man has no other choice really but to make and believe in some fiction or other. Perhaps the ultimate judgment on a man is not whether he acquiesces to a fiction, but rather what kind of fiction will persuade him into that acquiescence, that willing suspension of disbelief." And so the picture on the right is a picture depicting or an illustration for an article that was in the New York Times Magazine concerning the civil war in the Sudan. I would say with almost 100% certainty that that image is a constructed image. having been in those places, you will rarely walk upon a scene and find these three skulls juxtaposed to an army troop walking down a road. It doesn't happen. You create it, and you make a powerful statement by doing so. This picture on the left is the beginning of some work by George Roger. He's an English photographer who was one of the founders of Magnum, the great photo documentary agency founded by Cartier-Bresson, Robert Capper, George Roger, and I think a few other people. And this picture is particularly poignant for me. It's one of the images that I saw early on in my own studies of photography. It's also an image that has had a great impact on the people it's depicting, which are, in this case, the Nubas of the southern or western Sudan. I'd like to just read to you again, and then I'll be done with quotes for a while, a little paragraph about this image. The crowning experience and achievement of the journey came to its end in the mountains of the Kordofan province in southern Sudan. They found the people entirely strange, fascinating, and likable, as well as the most hospitable in Africa. The Nuba found the Rogers equally interesting, and the women, who had never encountered a white female before, touched and prodded Sicily to satisfy their entirely friendly curiosity. Happily, Roger did not know that their visit was, in fact, the first link in a chain of events that would bring great ill fortune to these people. Among many beautiful photographs, he made one particularly striking picture of a wrestler being carried in triumph on the shoulders of another after one of their fierce bouts of fighting. The magnificent specimen of manhood seems the epitome of the noble savage, and despite his awesome strength, is much more impressive than alarming. When she saw the photograph in Stern magazine, Leni Riefenstahl, the famous German film director and friend of Hitler who made the extraordinary Nazi propaganda film, The Triumph of the Will, was overwhelmed by it and asked Roger exactly where the tribe was located. He very understandably refused to say, as the horrors inflicted by the Nazis were still fresh in his mind and always would be, and he had no wish to help a sworn admirer of Hitler. 15 years later, however, she arrived there and took a remarkable series of color photographs that were published all over the world. They became justly famous and immediately attracted more visitors to the area. The reaction of the Puritan Islamic government of the Sudan was to encourage encroachment and oppress their culture to the degree that has now amounted to the destruction of these people as a free people. So throughout the groups of slides tonight, I'll talk a little bit more about the responsibility of the photographer and also the responsibility of how we put those images out there. The pictures on the left are by George Roger. The pictures on the right are done at the same time period. Roger's pictures are around 1949, 1950, 1954. The ones on the right are by Seydou Keita, the great portraitist of Mali, of Bamako, and they're of society there, and they were all done in the late 1940s up until 1957, the images in this group. I think you can see the difference of portrayal and what can happen when a photographer makes a certain decision to portray peoples in certain ways. Picture on the left is the executioner with his symbolic axe. That's from Uganda in 1954. The picture on the right is entitled Autoportrait. Also from 1954 by Seydou Keita. Now this is the last of Seydou Keita's pictures on the right. I think it's an incredibly complex and lovely image. And Keita often used props in order to dress up his customers and present them in a certain light which they wanted to be presented. If you get a copy of this month's Harper's Bazaar, you can see some new pictures by Seydou Keita. He's 76 years old. And they so loved... Let's see if I can do this right. Okay. They so loved the style of his work that they went and took some very fancy clothes, Jean-Paul Gaultier and Armani and other people's, to Bamako and asked if he would do a fashion shoot. And the ones on the left are the present-day images that he's created for that fashion shoot. I think it's also, as lovely as the one on the left is, you can see that it, or for me anyhow, it has a feeling that it is a fashion shot, as opposed to the one on the right, which has some other feelings and depth to it. These images are by the great American photographer Paul Strand. They were done in Ghana in 1963 and 64. Strand is one of the true humanists in photography, and he went there to capture an emerging new nation, or a nation that had just changed from colonial rule to independence. And I think there's a kind of respect and dignity that is in this group of pictures that we often don't see in images that are depicting Africa. This last group that I'll show you of someone else's work is by Malik Sidibe. These were done in the 1960s. At the same time, Strand was working in Ghana, West Africa. Sidibe was working in Mali, West Africa. It's probably pretty obvious that what I'm trying to show you, if one searches for the imagery, you find that Africa is not always an open-air ethnographic museum. It's quite modern, quite complex, and quite absorbing. These are young men who had gone through a ritual circumcision. And I think it's a very respectful portrait as opposed to something that has tried to manipulate that situation. This is Christmas Eve, 1964. And I believe this is the last of Sidibe's pictures, a picture of a boxer done in 1966. My own motivation and draw to Africa had to do with all the myths that I had encountered and still encounter and have to try to figure out. And I was flooded with them as a child, the wonderment of place, its people, its smells, its sounds. And what I wanted to do was go and experience firsthand what that was, as opposed to seeing it through other people's eyes. To learn more about myself in this world, meaning this world here and this world wherever I happen to be, and the people who share their experiences with me about our common humanity. So that's kind of the premise from which I move in my own work. Okay, these are all images from the forthcoming book entitled Another Africa. And I won't give you captions for all of them, just some. The one on the right are ceremonial dancers at the Paris-Dakar race, the finish of the race in Senegal. This image is of a young student in the Kakuma refugee camp. He's a southern Sudanese. There's a group called the Unaccompanied Minors. These are young boys who left the Sudan en masse, 20,000 of them in the late 1980s, and traveled in groups across southern Sudan into Ethiopia, were forced out of Ethiopia back to southern Sudan, eventually ending up in northern Kenya. They left their homes, their families, and their way of life in order to pursue their education and to try to break out of the mold that was one of either being drafted into the Northern Army of the Republic of the Sudan or into the SPLA, the Sudanese People's Liberation Organization, Army. Could you focus that one, please? Thank you. This is New Year's Day, 1990, in Khartoum, in the Sudan, and these are southern Sudanese celebrating. Most of the south of the Sudan is Christian, the north is Muslim, and so that's been the basis of some serious disagreements. Also, the south has oil, so the north would like to have control of the south. In breaking down the types and or conceptions, I use the photographs to lead me to what it is I'm seeing. As I begin to accumulate certain types of moments, they reveal to me certain mysteries and suggest ways of looking at what I'm seeing. And I would say an equal amount of these photographs are constructed or posed, and many are seen in a fleeting moment. This is one of my favorite images. This is the only picture of a white person in the book. I think it's very appropriate. It's also an homage to the great photographer Robert Frank, for those of you who are familiar with photography. He did a wonderful book called The Americans. I'm often drawn by a variety of things, but gesture, light, and formal concerns, and those things mixed with emotion of the moment are usually what draw me and sustain me to a situation or to make a certain kind of image. Sometimes, as in the case of that picture of Simon in the classroom, I saw that in a very brief moment, but in order to make that image, I needed to recreate it. It's a very long exposure, so I had to set up and ask him to stay the way he had been or to go back to the way he had been, which was a little bit difficult because there were about 150 people peering in every window because they were so curious. But what happens is one is able, if you're willing, to go with the moment to reconstruct it and maybe get some beautiful surprise out of it. The pictures that you're seeing range from 1989 through 1997. And I often am overseas for 3 or 4 months, or in some cases longer, some cases shorter. One thing that I've been fortunate in doing is to be able to go back to places. And so in repeated visits to an area, what seems at first exotic or out of the ordinary, or the romantic notions that one might bring or I might bring to the situation, change, and I start to see it in a very different light. This is another time when I was walking down a road in Ghana. This was in late August of 1997. And from the road, I could see this woman behind the screen. And I wanted to get the image, but I didn't want her to move. And she had called out to me because I was this odd character walking down out of the ordinary. And it's a kind of dance that one does to keep somebody in that same place when you first have seen them, and to try to get the image, because the immediate thing when the camera goes up to my eye is for who's ever in front of the camera to want to straighten up and get a little more formal and make themselves, present themselves in the best way possible. Often that loses the moment, and actually the camera has a way of changing those moments and not presenting them in their best form possible, but transcending that and making them not look so well. So it's always a fun dance back and forth. Dr. of Shoe is a sign in Ghana, and then this was actually the work of a Doctor of Shoes in Kampala, Uganda. Ultimately, what I want to tell you is that this is, I want to emphasize that these pictures represent my Africa, the experience I have, something that's going on with my interactions in that place. I'm not trying to tell you that this is Africa. This is a particular view, and it's only one view. For as many different people who live there and who go there, there are that many views of Africa. What I'm hoping to do is to show you what we share, what human beings share, rather than saying what the differences are. I'd like to celebrate what the commonness that we have with one another. I believe the next few portraits are also from Kakuma. This is a southern Sudanese woman, a Nuer woman from the Nuer tribes, and some of the others will be Dinka, and within each of those general headings, there are many other kinds, many distinctions. There's one last quote I would like to read to you. This is by the American photographer Robert Adams from his book Beauty and Photography. The point of art has never been to make something synonymous with life, however, but to make something of reduced complexity that is nonetheless analogous to life and can thereby clarify it. Interesting that Chinua and his family and I had some time together this afternoon, and we were talking about the book and the poems and the pictures, and one of the things that came up in the book, the captions are at the end of the book, because I don't want people to read the captions and influence the way they see the pictures. I want you to be able to look at the pictures and glean from them what you will, and maybe go back to them often, I hope, to try to see what other layers there are there. This is great. This is a little domestic squabble in one of the places I was traveling, and they allowed me the honor of sitting there and not only watching it, but to be able to photograph without throwing me out. I was very privileged. I believe this is the last image tonight, and this is an image of, it's entitled Falasha Priest. These are all black Ethiopian Jews, and this is an image from 1991 at the end of their time in Africa. Most of these people were airlifted out and seemingly wanted to leave Africa or Ethiopia at the time. I think since then a number have returned. And these two men on the right are being reunited with their uncle, who they hadn't seen in 12 years. Oops, there's a couple more, I guess. Sorry. The title for this picture is Embarkation Points of Slaves to the New World. This is an actual point where slaves were shipped from in Benin. And there are many such points on the west coast of Africa, in Ghana, in also Cote d'Ivoire. And this was one that there had been a commemoration and a road that led down to this beach, and with the story of what had happened. You know, I took this picture because I thought that stool was just incredible, a great piece of modernist furniture and design. And I was lucky enough to have the picture of Moussa Traoré in the upper left. Right about the time I made this picture, they were overthrowing him in Bamako. There was a coup d'etat. And I went back a few months later, and instead of having that picture hanging there, there was a large clock that, you know, like a wristwatch, but big, and it said Winston on it. And I thought that was really appropriate. This is better as the sight. I can't read it. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. Particularly appropriate for James Bond. Something happens when the camera, when I have the camera with me, I'm never nervous. I can go into situations I would never go into normally. And I can confront people. I think photography is a predatory act in the way that I practice it, and so I take a certain responsibility for that. There are times when people get upset, and you know, there's always another picture to be made, so I would much rather let it go. There's often times when I make a picture and then they're upset, and then it takes some smoothing out. But with a camera, I'm able to go into situations that I think I would probably just never encounter otherwise. And it's one of the great beauties. I would say it might even be analogous to, you know, how one might decide to compose music or paint. It gives you a certain insularity from the repercussions of the world. This is the last image, sorry. And I would tell you that I draw my inspiration from literature and painting, sights and smells and sounds in these places, and of the moment. Thank you. So I think we're going to have a little bit of a discussion. I know we're running a little longer this evening. And talk a little bit more about Africa and take some of your questions. One of the reasons I want to continue to pound in this idea of how Africa is covered, this is a recent Time magazine that was done during Clinton's trip to Africa. And I was just appalled when I read the first line of the article. It says, "Hope is Africa's rarest commodity." It's just a ridiculous line to start an article, because hope is actually the commodity that is most abundant in Africa and many other places. And I was really angered by that. Of course, the article goes on to talk a little bit more and tell us a little bit how things are so hopeful in Africa by Western standards. So one of the things that I think is important to think about is, by whose standards do we judge or think about Africa, and how other people think about it?
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I've made it my life's work to talk about my home, because I couldn't find in the books I read, in the pictures I saw, and the thinking that I encountered, any awareness of myself. This is really how my interest in writing came about, because you see, every people have their story. And we in Africa were in the unfortunate position of not having our story in the gallery of world stories. And this struck me even as a child. I began by not recognizing my absence. I assumed that I was the same as Conrad's people, the people in the boat, the white people going up the Congo. You see, I thought I was one of them. I did not realize I was one of those on the banks, you know, jumping up and down. You know, I did not identify with those people jumping up and down, because they were not presented in a way that would appeal to me. And being so young, I just was fascinated by the courageous white person besieged by savages, and I took sides with a courageous man, you see. But when I realized that I was one of the savages, I then recognized that my story was not there. That story which I read and thought was me was not. And it doesn't take very long to see that, if you were in my position. What is difficult is perhaps to persuade other people to recognize that absence that struck me. And this has been, for me, a very challenging and a most frustrating sometimes, but very exhilarating at other times, experience. So the pictures, the presentation, you know, in fact, things have improved, because I have had to go back to the beginnings of this representation and to discover, in fact, that there was a reason for it. The reason had to do with the slave trade. The reason had to do with explaining the maltreatment of these people. It had to, you know, it was invented to explain the necessity for colonization. And so it has a long history, and it has this rationale. And this is why it is so difficult to defeat. But I think the world needs to do that, because unless it does, it will not be a safe place. It will not be safe for our children. It's very important, I think, that we defeat this attempt to put some people down, because nobody would allow you to do that forever. And also, as you are doing it, you see, my people have a proverb which is very, very interesting. It says, to hold somebody down in the mud, you have to be there. And so I don't really want anybody to be down there with me. You know, I want to be up. I want all of us to be up. And this is why it's not simply a question of taste. It's a question of safety. The safety of the human race.
I think it's interesting, because when Chinua and I first met, I remember I dragged a lot of pictures to him so he could see them, to see if he would even consider doing something together. And of course I'd read everything I could find, but I didn't have the book of poems at that point. It wasn't available, I don't think. And I remember being very nervous bringing the pictures to show you. And there was a picture, the one I commented on, a little bit of a domestic squabble. And I remember that was the one that we stopped at. And you really got a chuckle from that. And I knew then that we were on the same, some similar wavelength. And I'm much younger at it and in a much different place, from a different place. But there was I was able to find something that I was coming across consistently in my depictions, and I had gleaned that inspiration from, and that way of seeing from reading both Chinua's work and others, to have a different view, to seek out this other view, which we've been talking about the last few days. And there's a wonderful book of essays called Hopes and Impediments, which Chinua wrote, and which you deal with a lot of issues, the responsibility of the writer, and also truth in fiction, which I think just transcends and works in all of the forms of art. And I guess I would ask you a little bit about that, about the response. We've been talking about the responsibility of the artist, but also the ideas around that truth in fiction.
Well, it seems to me that fiction is so important. Well, I prefer to call it stories. For whatever reason, stories seem to be so important to our humanity. There is no human group anywhere that does not have stories. It seems to be, our humanity seems to be hinged somehow on our ability to make stories, to tell stories about ourselves and about others. There is no group either that does not have, perhaps, does not prefer its own ways to the ways of their neighbors. There's nothing wrong with that. It's really a question of degree. You don't want to think of your neighbors as less than human. I think if you get to that point, then there is some problem. What I want to convey about Africa is its complexity, because the human condition is very complex. Any attempt to simplify it, to make it easy and digestible, generally falsifies. It is this complexity that seems to me to be at stake in a lot of the discussion we get. You see, the two poems I read, for instance, to other poets, one of them I wrote in English, the other one I wrote in Igbo. Now, there's a good reason for that. The reason is that I have these two languages. Now, there are some of my friends who, for instance, think or believe that since English was imposed on us by our colonial masters, our business should be to reject it and embrace our mother tongue. My position is this. It is true that to some degree, my mother tongue was put in a subordinate position by colonialism. But I've been learning the English language since I was 5, 6, 7. And I'm now 60-something. Now, to turn around and say, this language is my enemy, seems to me rather silly. Because, you see, a language is nobody's enemy. A language is a tool. And what I say to my friends who are worked up about using European languages, okay, now if you feel uncomfortable doing it, don't do it. There's really no need for an argument. If you don't feel like using any particular language, then don't use it. You don't have to have a war about this. And so, in a way, this is an indication of this complexity I'm talking about. Actually, some of our best writers and best minds are aware of this. There is a very fine novel, one of the best novels on colonialism, by a Muslim Senegalese called Hamidou Kan, Sheikh Hamidou Kan. In this novel called Ambiguous Adventure, the African people he is talking about are in a crisis. Their grandfather was defeated by the French, and now their territory is run by the French. And the French have built their schools. And these people, the leaders of this group, the Dialobe people, are debating, shall we send our children to the French schools? And opinion is divided. Some people say, no, that will kill our culture. That would kill what is of value to us, the spirit. And they're talking about it. And one very influential member of the aristocracy, who is called the most royal lady, she gets up and says to her kinsmen, one day, our grandfather woke up to the sound of guns from the river. He assembled his elite and went down to defend his land. They were defeated. She says, why? How? There is nothing in our philosophy that would explain how what happened. And the only way we can do it is to go to those people And they can teach us how to win without being in the right. So that's really what we are doing. We need to go to learn how to win without being in the right. That's a very sad thing to say. But, you know, we have to come to terms with that kind of thinking. And that's really the answer to those who say, throw out everything that these people brought. We need, and in fact, we already use these tools to fight for our independence. We haven't quite won it completely, but the tool was valuable. That's how complex Africa is.
I think we're going to take a few questions as well. This is a question for you, Chinua. What is the status of the Igbo tribe today?
We don't like the word tribe, simply because of the baggage it carries. I know it is difficult to find another word, but the Igbo people are going through a very difficult period in their history. But they've been going through very difficult periods for a long time. In the last century, there was an Igbo man who said that when he died, he would come back, not as a human, but as a piece of rock. Stone. That for an Igbo man, that was the most terrifying, the most terrifying thing to say about your future. That man must have been going through very, very terrible times. And the 19th century was a very bad time for Igbo people. But they are still knocking around. You see, this is one thing about people who are old in the world. They take a lot of beating. And so that is the situation today. The Igbo people were particularly damaged by the civil war in Nigeria. But they're still knocking around. And I think they will go on doing that. Culture is not as fragile as we sometimes think. It's tougher than we think.
Okay, I'm going to take one. The question is, how do you request and receive permission to take someone's photo and maintain or create respect for the person being photographed? Sometimes I ask permission. Often people either speak French or English in places I'm traveling, and I'm always accompanied by someone who speaks other languages that are local to that particular area, and those are usually people who I work with over a long period of time, and I just ask. Sometimes I don't ask, as I said, it's predatory. And I have to deal with the consequences after or during. How do I maintain or create respect? I think you'd have to be the judge for that from the pictures. For me, I'm respectful of the people that I'm photographing. They're collaborators in creating a piece. So always I enter from that point of view.
I think this is the shortest.
Okay.
Who are the important African writers today? And the reason is shorter is that I don't answer that question. There are very many, and many of them are my friends. And if I start any list, I'm going to leave out some of my best friends, and the news will get back to them. So there are many. And really, if you are interested, if you go into any bookshop and start with anybody you find, and you know, it will grow on you. This is something 30 years ago when I began writing. It's more than 30, it's 40. I can't believe it. It was a different time, but it, you know, it just happened. It just exploded. So it's literally impossible to give you a short list. There are very, very many in from all parts of the continent, north, west, east, south.
Thank you, Chinua Achebe, Mrs. Achebe. Thank you, the audience, and all the people of Portland Arts and Lectures. I think that's a good place to stop.
You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. That was legendary African writer Chinua Achebe and his talk from 1998. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We have lots of other talks on the website. Listen to them all at literary-arts.org. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting, produced by Spencer Raymond. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thank you for joining us.